Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Flomo versus Firestone. Mr. Levesque.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Paul Hoffman, and with Ms. Levesque, we represent the plaintiffs and appellants in the case. I will handle the arguments relating to corporate liability, and Ms. Levesque will handle the other arguments. We've asked for 11 minutes for my opening part and 3 for rebuttal, and 9 minutes for Ms. Levesque and 2 for rebuttal. With respect to the issue of corporate liability, Judge LaValle's concurring opinion in the Kiobel case certainly presents our views about that issue in considerable detail.
And does that dispose of the argument then?
Excuse me? Well, I would hope so, but probably not, as my guess.
Well, I just wondered whether you were going to rest on it.
Excuse me? No, we're not resting on it. What I'd like to do with the time that I have is to focus on a few points and maybe elaborate on them from our perspective. The first one being the Kiobel majority's misstatement and misuse of footnote 20 in the Sosa opinion. I think it's clear from the Sosa opinion itself that, first of all, that the Supreme Court was not making a ongoing sort of widespread choice of law decision in a footnote. But besides that, there's a particular context in the Sosa opinion that makes it absolutely clear that what they were talking about was the difference between law of nations violations that required some connection to state action and law of nations violations that that didn't require state action and that could be committed directly by private actors, whether they were corporate entities or individuals. The reason this came up in a question, I believe, from Justice Souter, because there was a question about whether Mr. Sosa, who was a private actor, was properly there to begin with, because the norm was clearly a norm that required state action, arbitrary arrest. And the reason that he was there was that the United States had conceded earlier in the case that he acted under color of law. In addition to that, the only other reference to this issue, that, at least that I can recall, is in the European Commission brief where they talked about the differences in norms between those requiring state action and those requiring private action, but no brief in the Sosa case dealt with the question of corporate liability. And in the very next footnote, in footnote 21 of the Sosa opinion, the court discusses the apartheid cases without any indication that there's a problem about suing corporations. So, and I think that the Kiobel majority recognizes that, that this was about state action. Judge LaValle explains that footnote 20 actually supports.
I wouldn't fuss about a footnote so much.
Your Honor, let me move.
There's something better to say than talk about a footnote.
Well, Your Honor, the reason I think it's important is that the only basis for the majority opinion is they claim that Sosa requires
which majority?
This result.
What are you talking about? What majority opinion?
The Kiobel majority, which is what the court below relied upon, bases its position that
it's a long opinion. It's got more. It's not just about the footnote.
Well, but that's the only source for finding that international law is there, because if you went through the Sosa analysis, you would go to the text of the.
Why don't you give a reason why you think corporations should be potentially liable under the Alien Tort Statute?
Well, Your Honor, yes. The first reason is that the text, as the Supreme Court in Amarato Hess said, does
not. That's another bad argument. It's a 1789 text.
But the text, the founders knew when to.
They didn't know about corporations, right? They weren't.
They did. They knew about corporations. There was corporate liability. In the law of nations, ships were often the defendants in law of nations cases, not individuals. They were defendants in cases.
Now that's a good point. The ships. All right.
Well, but the point, I think, is that there was not a focus only on individuals. And in fact, the reason why ships were defendants in piracy cases, for example, were that the point of the Alien Tort Statute was to provide remedies and tort remedies and the founders knew what torts meant. There wasn't a criminal statute. There were criminal statutes passed at the same time for those kinds of issues. They consciously passed the tort statute, and its derivation in the history that was relied upon by SOSA was the 1781 Continental Congress resolution that asked states to pass tort remedies in addition to any criminal sanctions for violations of the law of nations, because the Continental Congress did not have the authority to do anything about those questions, including the Marbois incident, the other similar incident of an attack on ambassadors that happened after that to a Dutch ambassador in New York. And the author of the Alien Tort Statute, Oliver Ellsworth, was also part of the Connecticut delegation that was the only state that actually passed tort remedies in response to the 1781 Continental Congress. So there's a lot of history about which SOSA talks about, in which you have this framework for a tort statute, not a criminal statute. And that's one of the other places, I think, where the Kiobel majority goes wrong, in that they look exclusively at international criminal tribunals when this is a tort statute. And Congress certainly had the right to enforce the law of nations by a tort statute, and it clearly did so by the plain words of the statute. The history also, in addition to supporting the application of the law of nations to things that are not individuals, there's no information that anyone has come up with that the founders might have intended to exclude corporations or private entities or partnerships or anything other than individuals from the scope of the remedy that they were putting together. And there's no plausible reason why they would do so, because the whole point of this was to make sure.
Well, is it your view that if there's a violation of one of these international norms by a corporate employee, the corporation is automatically liable?
I don't think that this case raises the question of respondeat superior, and so I'm not sure.
Why not? I don't understand.
I think that I think that if it was just any action by any employee, I'm not so sure that international law would go that far. But I think when the corporation.
Not so sure. Do you have a position on it? What is the liability of a corporation? Is it pure respondeat superior, or is something more required?
I think you would apply federal common law tort principles as our position.
Give me an answer, right? What would be the standard for holding a corporation liable?
Your Honor,
is it just that the employee was acting within the scope of his employment, or is there something more?
All the cases that have been brought.
Just answer my question.
I don't know the answer to your question.
Well, it's kind of fundamental, isn't it? I mean, it's very important to your case, because it depends on the relationship between Firestone, the corporation, and the individuals who you say overlooked this child labor.
Your Honor, I think that the question would be, at least to my mind, I think Ms. Levesque may have a better answer on the facts of this case. I mean, the question that I'm confronting is whether corporations can ever be liable in any situation, which is what Kiobel deals
with. Well, I'm interested in whether they can be liable in this situation.
Your Honor, in this situation,
they can't be liable in this situation, sort of academic, where they can be liable in some other situation.
Well, I think the reason they can be held liable in this situation, and Ms. Levesque can answer this in more detail, is that the highest levels in the Firestone company knew about what was going on. It was their policies that led to this. It was not the acts of just one low-level employee acting within the scope of authority. That's not the theory of our case. And so the theory of the case is that the corporation was implicated by the acts of its highest officials.
So are you saying the violation has to be the result of a decision at the decision-making level of the corporation? Is that your argument?
Certainly every case.
Well, yes.
Yes, I think that there has to be some, at least in my view of it, the corporation at the higher levels has to be involved in knowing about the situation and failing to take action or taking action that leads to the violation. That it's not the isolated activities of of corporate employees.
Do you think before they passed the rule about child labor that they were knowledgeable of what went on and acquiesced to it?
That's the evidence that we presented, and that's the position that we have in the case.
But before 2005 or whatever it was?
Yes. I mean, I think there was reason. Again, Ms. Levesque has that evidence, and that was what she was going to deal with. But yes, that's my understanding. The evidence, the summary judgment evidence, is yes, that they did know that, and that's the basis for the claim in this case. If the court would like to focus on those questions, maybe I should preserve the rest of my time for rebuttal and have Ms. Levesque answer those questions since
that,
the court's
interested. That would be fine. Thank you.
For Christian Levesque. Of the arguments that we raised in our briefing, I'd like to focus predominantly on three main errors of law that the district court committed, two concerning summary judgment, which includes the issues of evidence that the court has raised, and one concerning issue of denying this amendment in this case. The district court determined that the appellants had failed to put forth sufficient evidence in support of their claims for the worst forms of child labor under. Alternatively, the district court, Judge Stinson, reconsidered Judge Hamilton's earlier legal ruling in which he had determined that, quote, it would not take great judicial creativity to determine that even paid labor of very young children in these heavy and hazardous jobs would violate the norms, the international norms under the SOSA standard. The worst forms of child labor in this case are defined under international.
I think your big problem is Article 4 of this International Labor Organization Convention. The notion that the norm against hazardous labor is subject to national laws and regulations. Because the problem is that the use of children in agricultural labor is extremely common. And it's probably never that great for kids, but the degree of hazard must vary enormously depending on things like, you know, are they working with pesticides and this and that and the other thing, right? So there doesn't seem to be a crystallized norm against child labor that's hazardous.
I respectfully disagree. Article 4 of ILO 182 does have the provision that you indicated, which, very consistent with international law, individual countries are to establish implementing legislation. But what Article 4 also does is it requires that countries refer not only to Article 3D, which defines the worst forms of child labor as a form of labor that's hazardous or likely to harm the health or safety. But it also requires that each
but
country...
But hazardous is so vague. That's the problem. There are small, slight hazards, and there are grave hazards.
Yes, but Article 4 also requires that each country not only refer to Article 3D, but has a duty and an obligation to refer to Recommendation 190.
Anyway, I think your argument really comes down to the fact that if a company sets a high quota, a high output quota for agricultural workers, then they're going to have under pressure to use family members, including children, to help them.
I think that our theory.
That's really all you have in this case, right? You have a quota, a production quota, and you say that leads them to enlist their kids.
I think we have more than that in this case. I think that one facet of this case is that there is a quota. The quota, though, is not simply, an amount of work that is slightly over what a regular person could do. It is grossly over.
Yes, I know. But see, the problem is when you try to apply a norm to the entire world, you know, 193 different countries. Are the courts going to be examining work quotas in 193 countries and see whether they're too great in one country and not in another?
The courts would be examining not just the work quotas, the courts would be examining the nature of the work with the guidance of Article 3D and the recommendation that I began to mention before, which walks the fact finder or the courts through step by step the considerations that a court or a fact finder must consider to determine whether the work is hazardous. Then taking that a step further, you would then look at the conduct of the defendant.
You don't even have any evidence as to how many children are involved. You just have your 23 plaintiffs.
Well, this case, actually, we do have evidence that there are more than 23 plaintiffs.
Where's the evidence?
The evidence is in our, well, first of all, this began as a class action, and of course, that.
Yeah, but it's not anymore.
We have evidence in our statement of facts as well as in our motions for summary judgment in which guardians, plaintiffs, supervisors who are retired headmen on the plantation talk about the fact that this was a systemic pattern and practice on the plantation. It was in no way limited geographically on the plantation or to simply our plaintiffs in this case. Now,
well, you have a quota, and the quota induces some of the parents to use children, but as far as we know, just 23 children.
Again, there is evidence in the record that would indicate that it is not just the 23
Well, how many
children.
Are there?
I'm sorry?
How many are there?
How many children? Thousands.
Thousands who are doing this work.
Who were doing this work during the time period of this case. And we have the evidence in the record that talks about eyewitness accounts. In addition, there are reports that have discussed this as a child labor as a widespread practice on the plantation. There is also Firestone's own.
What's your best evidence that there are thousands of kids involved?
The best evidence that there are thousands of kids involved is taking the amalgam of the evidence, the eyewitness accounts, not only from our plaintiffs, but also from supervisors who are on the Firestone plantation, the reports that I mentioned, and Firestone's own admissions in no less than three statements.
What's its admission?
I'm sorry?
The admission, what did it admit?
There are three of them, and likely more, but there are three. One was a 2000 memo that was from the then president and managing director of Firestone Liberia to the president of Firestone Natural Rubber Company, in which he acknowledged that this is a widespread practice on the plantation.
What were they doing? There's some talk about cleaning cups and other things about heavy lifting. And how do you distinguish among the children what they were doing? Because some of these people hired helpers for peanuts, you know, the cups of rice and, what, $20 a month or something? And they were adults. So what were the kids doing that was so bad?
Well,
specifically, not just they were there.
Certainly. The children were assisting with all facets of the tapper's job, and that's one of our main points, is that all of what the tapper does is considered hazardous. So
there's nothing a kid can do without getting hurt.
For a tapper, we believe that the various types of duties that a tapper does, not a person who works on the plantation in an office job, but a tapper, and what they did that was hazardous specifically was collecting coagulated cup lump, putting it into buckets on their head. The buckets weighed between 35 and 40 pounds when they were full to capacity, and they often were. They walked long distances in the heat. Often they had started early before the sun had even risen. They slashed with large cutlasses that were sharp-edged blades. They swung them back and forth to clear the jungle brush. They applied chemicals to the trees, both in the form of a fungicide as well as an insecticide. And when they did this, they did not have any protective equipment.
Well, what is the evidence of actual injuries?
The evidence is from our plaintiffs in this case, as well as the guardians. And the types of injuries that are in evidence are severe cuts and lacerations from the slashing that I discussed before with the long cutlasses. In addition, there was, for example, one child passed out from the fumes of ammonia. He inhaled the ammonia fumes, and he was at a high altitude at the tank, and he fell back, and he passed out. Boys getting and girls getting chemicals in their eyes and experiencing irritation, burning, things of that sort. In addition to those types of injuries, of course, emotional injuries, children talking about the fact that they believed because the quotas were so high and the fathers would not be able to complete their work, that if they the family did not work together, that they would not be able to eat. And you had mentioned that some of them paid helpers, and this was sort of mere peanuts. It was not mere peanuts for them, and often it required not only one helper but additional multiple people. So multiple children were helping them to complete their tasks.
When I say refer to peanuts, it's relative to what we look at. That's the trouble with these norms. Obviously, 319 a day sounds terrible, except those were jobs that were really coveted, and that seemed to be even give them the ability to hire someone else. So I use that phrase, but that may be wrong, because in that climate, or whatever you want to call it, that was normal.
They did not have enough, though, for them to be able to hire enough people. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. Unless there are questions right now, I can reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Levesque. Mr. Murray?
May it please the Court. In SOSA, the Supreme Court reiterated a dozen times that outside of such well-established matters as piracy...
No, forget SOSA. SOSA has that footnote which indicates that persons and corporations can be liable. You're not going to get anywhere with SOSA.
It certainly does, Your Honor, and that's the point. Outside of three narrow, modest norms recognized
Look,
in the statute...
Look, suppose Firestone went to the Liberian authorities and said, you know, we really want to reduce our labor costs. So could you just enslave some of your people and sell them to us, and we're going to have use slave labor for this rubber because it's going to be cheaper. Now, if they did that, do you think the corporation would not be liable under the Alien Tort Statute because it's a corporation?
Well, Your Honor, we have to talk about...
Answer my question.
No, I don't think they would be, Your Honor.
Well, okay, you've lost me, but go ahead.
Fair enough, Your Honor. Let me see if I can make this point, though. Individuals are the subjects of international law and not corporations. And
Why do you say that?
Well, I think the Kiobel majority with which we...
What is the sense of that? I mean, take my example, right? My example. So suppose it's not a corporation. Suppose it's a partnership. Are they liable? Is it liable?
Well, Your Honor, we think
Would you answer my question?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor.
You mean a partnership isn't liable, even though we treat a partnership as simply the collection of the partners, not as a separate entity, right? There's no limited liability.
Well, that's right, Your Honor. But
so why is a partnership different?
As the sources that Kiobel goes through make clear, international law focuses
on
the individual.
What if pirates form a corporation, okay? Indian Ocean Piracy, Inc. They have a bunch of pirates in Somalia and this and that, and they do piracy, right? So you're saying the individual pirates are liable, but the pirate corporation is not liable. Now, does that make sense?
I refer, Your Honor.
Explain to me how that makes common sense.
3 points, Your Honor. First, I'd refer the Court to Doe versus Nestle.
No. Answer my question. What is the common sense? You don't look in a court for common sense. Right?
Fair point, Your Honor.
Law is usually defined as common sense as amended by Congress, but go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. As a common sense matter, Your Honor, I don't know that I can stand here and make up common sense, but international law is not about common sense. International law is about...
Would you answer my question? I asked you whether there's some common sense reason to distinguish between the individual pirates and the pirate corporation. Now, if you want to say, no, there's no common sense reason, it's some legal technicality, fine.
Well, the common sense...
Fine. Is that what you're saying?
The common sense reason...
Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Then there is some common sense to this distinction between the corporation and the individual pirates. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, what is the common sense?
The common sense is because individuals and not corporations act. Individuals commit conduct that can violate international law. That's what the whole series of Bivens opinions are about. If we're going to use the power of law
now,
to determine...
Now, what is the common sense that says that only individuals and not corporations can violate international law?
Because it's the people who do the acts.
But that's true with ordinary domestic corporations, right? You have individuals do commit the tort, but the corporation is liable if they're acting within the scope of their employment. So tell me why that shouldn't be the same principle in international law.
Because there's no agreement in the law of nations as to what the standard for liability was. Your Honor asked whether respondeat superior would be enough, whether there would be some sort of control actor requirement. In Russia, a corporation can't violate a criminal law. In other countries, commonwealth
can't
violate the criminal law. In commonwealth countries, it requires a control actor.
Well,
requires
it doesn't
someone
have to
manage.
Be a violation of criminal law. This is a tort statute.
But again, in international law, there is no agreement in the law of nations as to how corporate liability would be imputed. And that just that's the simple common sense
point. Is that
point.
True about torts? Is that true of tort law?
Yes, Your Honor.
Don't all nations have corporate liability for acts of their employees?
All nations, I can't speak to whether all nations have that liability, but the way in which they impose it, as Your Honor focused on, is different. That's where the disagreement comes.
What's the difference?
So the point is whether it's...
What are the differences?
Whether it's respondeat superior, straight respondeat superior in the scope of the duty, whether it has to be someone at the management level.
They're conceding it has to be at the management level.
Well, but that's
are there countries that say even if the corporation does its bad deeds by direction of the board of directors, there's still no corporate liability?
I don't know that, Your Honor, but we're international.
So as far as you know, there's no such.
As far as I know, there's not, Your Honor. But
then what's your problem?
My problem is that SOSA doesn't say, look to the nations, find out what the lowest common denominator
is. SOSA, come on. SOSA is a long opinion with an ambiguous footnote, and it says, you know, we're going to keep the door ajar to expansions of this international liability. So you have to give me a good reason why it would be a bad thing to say that corporations that, you know, at the management level endorse child labor and so on, or slave labor, or genocide, or what have you, should be exempt.
Because what SOSA says is that when you look at the international norm, before we're going to decide that a norm is so well developed that we will apply it to all nations, that not only will American courts be able to do that, but Chinese courts, Japanese courts, it must be one that all nations agree on. It must be specific.
That's, of course, not true, right? When the Nuremberg Tribunal condemned the leaders of Germany, they were not enforcing a norm that all countries recognized, right?
Well, it has to be sufficient.
Germany didn't recognize it. Japan didn't recognize it. Soviet Union didn't recognize it. China didn't recognize it. South America didn't recognize it.
The point of SOSA is the norm has to
so
be
what's
universal.
The, so what's the, how, so do you think the Nuremberg Tribunal was illegitimate?
I don't.
But it didn't rest on a norm that was accepted by all nations.
And that's fair. I misspoke when I said all. What I meant was universal and specific.
No, it wasn't universal. Many major countries did not agree that there was anything wrong with aggressive warfare.
And SOSA didn't mean
all nations. They thought it was manly.
You know? What SOSA meant was that there has to be a specific norm.
You keep going back to SOSA. I'm asking you about the Nuremberg Tribunal, about your proposition that before a norm can be enforced under the Alien Tort Statute, it has to be accepted by all or the vast majority of nations.
The reason I keep going back to SOSA is because it's the only Supreme
you
Court
You don't
case
want to
on the
answer my
statute.
Question, right?
I don't know how to answer it other than I have, Your Honor. SOSA is the only
Supreme I'm
Court
asking
case.
You about the Nuremberg Tribunal. So you think SOSA says Nuremberg Tribunal was illegitimate because it didn't rest on a universal norm?
I think SOSA...
leaving SOSA out, do you think that the Nuremberg case was unique to the situation at the time? And it was certainly, there was no precedent for it anyplace else.
It was certainly unique to the situation at the time, Your Honor.
What effect would it have on this case?
Whether the Nuremberg... It's hard to understand how those two come together with the Alien Tort Statute.
Nuremberg was enforcing a criminal concept of crime against humanity.
That's right.
What's the difference between that and this one?
certainly they weren't enforcing against corporations, and that's the point of Chiavelle, is when the Nuremberg Tribunal.
So if the, but look, think of the Nuremberg Tribunal. They want to hang the German leaders. Are they going to say, well, also, we're going to hang these people, but while we're at it, we'd like to have as defendants some corporations so we can impose a fine on them? I mean, it'd look a little silly, wouldn't it?
Unless you consider the government's a body politic and corporate, which is how it's usually defined.
All I know is that the way the Nuremberg trials went down, corporations were involved, but they weren't held liable. They were only indicted, and to the point where...
So you think they couldn't have been punished by the Nuremberg Tribunal?
All I know is that they weren't.
No, no, I'm asking you, could they have been punished? Like the company that manufactured the poison gas, could they have been prosecuted civilly or criminally?
I don't believe they could have, Your Honor, no.
Assuming Germany was the corporate structure we're talking about, they weren't punished. The country wasn't punished, was it?
No, that's right, Your Honor. And, in fact, the Allies came together and took over, as you know, the various four zones in Germany.
The old rules of war said that the conquered country owes reparations. Is that an analogy or not?
Potentially, although there were no reparations against Germany in the Nuremberg trial. The subjects
not as a result of the Nuremberg trials, but in the abstract, there could have been. World War I certainly produced reparations. It's produced World War II, which produced a few other things, but that's... But the question is that the government, which is the corporate entity you might be talking, was not punished as a government.
That's right. So moving on, even if there could be corporate liability, despite Chiavelle, there's no sufficient norm in this case of international law that would impose liability. Again, if we look at the sources of international law, the plaintiffs have pointed to.
But wouldn't you agree there's some degree of mistreatment of children that would qualify or not?
Well, Your Honor, no, because if you look at the sources that have been raised here, two of them are conventions to which the United States has not signed on. And one,
well, what if you mean there's nothing that they could have done to these kids that would have violated international law?
Not that would be enforceable through the Alien Tort Statute, no, Your Honor.
If they enslaved them?
Oh, slavery may be different, absolutely. But as far as child labor and hazardous child labor, and that's the
what we're if the
about.
Evidence showed that these kids had a life expectancy of 3 years when they're working in the rubber plantation? That wouldn't make any difference to you?
No, Your Honor, not as a matter of international law. Slavery, genocide, crimes against humanity, those are different. But again, if you look at the sources of international law that have been raised here, none of them comes up
what
with
if
this kill,
What if 50% of the kids die within a year? And Firestone knows about it and says, yeah, well, you know, we've got to keep our costs down.
I mean,
and you say that wouldn't be
collateral damage, I believe.
I mean, and of course there's no evidence of that. There's no evidence that Firestone ever
employed anyone. I'm not asking you. I'm asking you a hypothetical question.
That's the hard part with international law, Your Honor.
No, look, don't evade me.
No, Your Honor.
I am asking you, if suppose Firestone says we know that when these kids are working in the rubber plantation, they have a life expectancy of 6 months, and you're saying that wouldn't violate any norm of international law. Is that what you're saying?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe it would. That's the hard part with international law. It's
I don't know what it's hard about. I mean, your position strikes me as ridiculous.
There
clearly is this norm about the worst forms of child labor, and the case I'm giving with the six-month life expectancy certainly is an example of a worst form of child labor abuse.
What the norm says, Your Honor, is work which, by its nature or circumstances in which it's carried out,
well,
is
I just gave you the example. The work is so terrible that they have a life expectancy of 6 months. Why isn't that the worst form of child labor?
Plaintiff's own expert agreed that likely, within that sentence, what is likely to cause harm to health, morals, or welfare.
I'm
is
sorry,
not
you're losing
law.
Me. I gave you a very simple example. It's a certainty, not a likelihood. You know, they have a life expectancy of 6 months because of these working conditions. Firestone knows it, condones it, keep labor costs down. And you're saying that's not a worst form of child labor.
No, Your Honor, because there's no international consensus as to that being the worst form of child labor. We may think that as Americans, but there's no international consensus. There's no established norm. To start with the broad
your
proposition.
Your position, that can't be right. I mean, that's crazy.
I know Your Honor doesn't want me to say it, but it's Sosa, Your Honor. You can't start with the broad proposition that at some level, look, in Sosa there were a survey of 119 countries that prohibited arbitrary detention.
Do any of them have working conditions which shorten the child's life expectancy to 6 months?
For purposes of your hypothetical, Sosa was about arbitrary detention, so no. For purposes of the hypothetical, 119 nations agreeing that arbitrary detention is bad was not enough in Sosa, because that's not the level at which we do international law. We look to a specific
Well, that's,
norm.
Of course, absurd. I mean, that's completely contrary to Nuremberg, since there were so many important countries that did not think that aggressive warfare was wrongful.
But as a practical matter, how would that norm be enforced, Your Honor? Even here in America, as Your Honor pointed out, 14-year-olds are allowed to work on only family farms. When you get to 16, you can work on another farm.
You seem unwilling to make rather simple distinctions. I'm talking about 14-year-olds working on American farms. My example is kids in Liberia with a 6-month life expectancy.
We don't believe there's an international law that is sufficiently specific.
Okay, that's your position. Now, what about the facts? So Ms. Levesque says that there's, you know, evidence that thousands of kids, suffer severe health problems from the pesticides, fungicides, and carrying heavy barrels on their head and so on. Now, can you comment on the evidence?
There's no evidence of thousands of anything in the record, Your Honor. Again, there were the 23 plaintiffs here. There's no record of thousands of anything. The evidence in the record is that before this suit was filed, 13 tappers were suspended consistent with the 2000 and 2005 Firestone policy that did not allow child labor on the farm. And the evidence is that since the suit was filed, 11 have been fired under the zero-tolerance policy, which Firestone adopted in 2005, that said anyone who participates in child labor or sees child labor and doesn't deal with it appropriately is terminated. In fact, two of the very guardians in this case were disciplined under
those policies. How many enforcers does Firestone have?
There are a number of people on the plantation. There are managers and there are head
managers. Well, how many?
It depends what you mean by enforcers. There are any number of Firestone employees throughout the...
Well, this plantation is 200 square miles, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And there are many thousands of people living there.
That's true.
Well, how many Firestone supervisors are there?
I don't have an aggregate number as I stand here, but each head man...
What do you mean as you stand here? Is it in the record?
I don't know that, Your Honor.
Is it anything in the record about the hazardous jobs for anybody? Because it seems to me, I have very little experience other than growing up on a farm and doing a lot of stuff. And also in Vietnam, I witnessed...
We may have a cause of action.
Just little girls carrying things that I couldn't pick up. They carry them on their shoulders and bounce, and I couldn't do it. But adults, what's the record on adults having faced hazardous conditions doing the same job and injuries and everything else? Because that would be... pretty obvious that that's hazardous if a lot of people, Judge Posner uses the hypothetical of lots of deaths. What's the status just of people in general who do this job?
So there are isolated bits of evidence as to adults suffering these sorts of injuries. The focus of the suit and the discovery was on the children and their injuries. Again, the way the evidence went in, it was undisputed that the adults could do the job with a helper that didn't have to be a child. In fact, it was undisputed that each of the guardians here did their jobs at times when they had no child helping them.
Yeah. Now, the other side, they were talking about jobs, the hazard about the slashing and stuff and things that swinging machete around or whatever else they do. Is there part of these jobs, a tapper, that children could do without being tortured or something?
Yes, Your Honor. As Judge Magnus Stinson held, there are parts like the washing out of cups or other non-hazardous parts that the children could do. And again, if the children did work at all and what they did, it's undisputed, was decided by their fathers, not Firestone. Firestone didn't employ these children. Firestone didn't require them to do anything at all. The fathers, not the children, made those choices. Unless the panel has any further questions.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Murray. So, Ms. Levesque, do you have anything further, or your co-counsel?
I have a specific question, not particularly hypothetical. If Firestone simply purchased the result of what was going on without having anything to do with the direction, but they knew what was going on when they purchased it, which then added to the problem, would Firestone still be liable?
And I'm sorry. I'm not sure I understand your
question. That is, they are separated. The work being done is directed entirely by a foreign corporation. It has nothing to do with Firestone. Firestone simply buys the product knowing that it is the product was a result of child labor. Can Firestone then be held liable?
I think that there would be a question if it was simply...
No, I want... No, do you think that would be liable? I'm going to do Judge Posner's game. Do you want to just answer my question?
Okay,
do you think
sure.
there's liability?
Sure. If they're simply buying a product and no, then I would say, knowing that it is being produced with child labor, then I would say no.
Why not? What's the difference?
I would, because it is far less direct and less intentional.
I mean, there's a
wall
between it. If they separate themselves from what's going on, blind themselves to it, they're not liable.
Not blinding themselves to it, there is a wall, but also in the scenario that you've presented, there is not an active and deliberate step where there is in this particular
They know
case.
Precisely that the product is a result of abusive behavior of children, mm-hmm. and they buy it anyway, and that creates the demand, the market, actually, so that they're productive.
I think that there could potentially be a case. It's just that here we have evidence that is so much far, it's much more direct.
But you think there could be liability in that case?
There could be, but it can't just be in the stream of commerce where they...
I have some shirts that were made in Bangladesh, and as near as I can tell, they're made by slave labor or some people are making a nickel a week or something. Is the company I buy my shirt from liable for the abuse that's going on in Bangladesh, assuming it's going on?
I think we're getting to that line.
I just want to know where the line was. I mean,
I would say that probably not under that scenario, simply because, again,
makes
they
me feel better. I don't have to give up my shirt.
but again, I do want to emphasize that the evidence here is that Firestone, the parent company, very directly from the highest level.
Well, when you say the parent, this Firestone Natural Rubber Company, this is a subsidiary.
Firestone Natural Rubber Company is the parent of Firestone.
No, but it's a subsidiary of what, Bridgestone?
Yes.
It's not the top of the chain. I'm pursuing Judge Bauer's question. I mean, so Would Bridgestone, as the owner of Firestone Natural Rubber Company, would it be liable? It's not one of your defendants, is it?
It's not one of our defendants.
Yep.
Correct. It is not. no, it is not, because we feel that we've appropriately sued Firestone Natural Rubber Company as the parent of Firestone.
That's the company
Firestone
operating
Liberia.
In Liberia.
I'm sorry?
Firestone Rubber Company is the one operating in Liberia?
Firestone Liberia, formerly Firestone Plantation Company, is what operates in Liberia.
And are you suing that also?
No, we are suing the parent company, Firestone Natural Rubber.
But isn't that a little like Judge Bauer's question, that you're at one remove from the actual malefactor?
No, and the reason is because here, Firestone Natural Rubber Company very directly set the conditions of...
Not just quotas.
They set the course. They set the course, and they did so in...
Quotas.
They set the quotas, but they also set the policies as well that were passed but were not being enforced. And when we say set the quotas here, we're talking about the president of Firestone Natural Rubber Company admitting that the work that an average tapper has to do equates to 21 hours of work. We're talking about Firestone Natural Rubber Company, the parent company, acknowledging in admissions, in memos, that they know child labor is occurring. We're talking about Firestone Natural Rubber Company with its policies and admitting that it knows child labor is occurring, not enforcing those policies. It is undisputed in the record that the 2000 policy that Firestone had, which was entitled The Elimination of the Worst Forms of Child Labor, in which it had identified every job that the children did and called it, quote, an intolerable form of child labor. In that very, that it is undisputed that that particular policy was never enforced for 5 years, undisputed. at the five-year mark, then it becomes disputed evidence where our plaintiffs and guardians have testified in their depositions that this policy, the new policy, was still not being enforced, and Firestone supervisors were actively encouraging them to work, not just seeing them work, but encouraging them to work, and that the parent company knew that that was occurring. So this is a very direct violation that's going on here, a very direct involvement on the part of Firestone Natural Rubber Company.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Levesque. Your time has expired. So we thank both sides. Move on to our next case.